This is Audible.
Welcome. You are about to embark on a unique learning adventure from the Great Courses. Our courses are crafted to be entertaining journeys, both comprehensive and fascinating. They're designed to expand horizons, deepen understanding, and foster epiphanies in a broad array of subjects and university-level disciplines. The lecturers are university professors and subject matter experts carefully selected by the Great Courses and its customers for their intellectual distinction and exceptional abilities to teach. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalogs or visit our website at thegreatcourses.com and imagine how much you can learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the company of some of the greatest minds in the world.
Welcome to the Masters of Mindfulness. In this course, Dr. Shauna Shapiro and 10 of her colleagues will take you on a guided tour of the many ways mindfulness can help you reduce stress and pain, improve your health, increase your happiness, and find meaning in your life. You'll explore both the modern science and the ancient wisdom behind mindfulness, and you'll learn practical techniques to integrate this powerful tool for positive change into your daily routine. Dr. Shapiro introduces the concept of mindfulness and shows you how you can begin practicing it. Dr. Rick Hansen teaches you to use mindfulness to strengthen your inner resources while making the most of positive experiences. Through powerful stories of grief and transformation, author Christine Carlson illustrates how mindfulness can help you rediscover your passion after shattering heartache and loss. Mindfulness coach Juna Mustad teaches you to mind stigmatized emotions like anger for the hidden gems they contain. Author and speaker Mike Robbins illustrates how organizations, leaders, and employees can bring compassion, authenticity, and effectiveness into the workplace. Dr. Amishi Jha takes you on a deep dive into the neuroscience of attention and presents the mounting evidence that mindfulness training really is an effective type of brain training. And by sharing her research on telomeres, which protect our chromosomes from damage, Dr. Alyssa Epple explains how mindfulness techniques allow you to live younger, healthier, longer. Author and spiritual teacher Jessica Graham reveals how mindfulness can revitalize your sex life and deepen communication with your partner. Professor Dacher Keltner shows how the emotion of awe defines us as human beings. And he teaches you to cultivate your own experiences of awe. You'll also learn about Blue Mind, a revolution in environmental awareness and activism, from marine biologist Wallace J. Nichols. And finally, Dr. Dan Siegel will take you on a journey of personal transformation through what he calls Mindsight and the Wheel of Awareness. Masters of Mindfulness was shot on location at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California, the birthplace of the human potential movement. Since 1962, Esalen has provided a unique and beautiful sanctuary for anyone interested in exploring human consciousness and finding new connections between the self, society, and the universe. Whether you're a beginner or a longtime practitioner of mindfulness, this course will deepen your understanding and help you to integrate mindfulness at home and at work, in your relationships and your self-identity, and as you grow and evolve. Lecture 1. What you practice grows stronger.
Welcome. So let's begin by just arriving here together. Take a moment to let your eyes close and just gather your attention in your body. Maybe feel your feet, wiggle your toes, Just arriving. Take a moment to feel your breath. And as you're ready, letting your eyes open, welcome. I'm Dr. Shauna Shapiro, and I'm delighted to be sharing this course with you. Mindfulness, the art of being present, has revolutionized the lives of millions, and I'm delighted to welcome you to this journey, one that will empower you with scientific knowledge and teach you valuable skills to improve your life. The beauty of mindfulness is that you can begin in any moment. No matter what your circumstances, it is never too late. As Kabir beautifully says, wherever you are is the entry point. So let's begin. The word mindfulness means to see clearly. We want to see clearly so we can respond effectively. There's been an explosion of research demonstrating the beneficial effects of mindfulness. It's good for us. It strengthens our immune system, it decreases stress, lowers cortisol, improves our sleep. It also has significant cognitive capacities, increasing our focus, our attention, our memory, our creativity and innovation. And perhaps most importantly, mindfulness improves our ethical decision-making, it reduces our cultural bias, and it increases our compassion. In this world of increasing complexity, mindfulness is a powerful tool. So again, mindfulness means to see clearly so we can respond effectively. The way we do this involves three core elements: intention, attention, and attitude. I want to speak about each of these three elements and show how they work together synergistically. The first is intention, simply knowing, why are you paying attention? What's important? One of my favorite sayings is the most important thing is simply to remember the most important thing. Just remembering what's important to you. So I want to share a story about my son, Jackson. A couple years ago when he was 9 years old, I was away teaching in Europe and we were apart for 2 weeks, which was the longest we'd ever been apart. And on the flight home from Copenhagen, I started getting really anxious. I'd missed him terribly and I was worried that I'd been away too long or I had ruined our attachment bond. And so instead of starting to shame myself and judge myself, I set a really clear intention. When I get home, I just want to let Jackson know I love him. Mom is home. You're safe. So I arrived home on a Saturday. It was this beautiful day and we decided to go to the beach together. And I start packing up our picnic and packing his favorite foods and gathering all his toys. And I walk out to my car and I'm waving to the neighbors. I'm like, look, I'm home. See what a good mom I am. You know, this isn't going to end well. So I go back inside, say, Jackson, let's go. And he's like, nah, I don't feel like it. I'm like, what? We're going to go to the beach and I'm going to show you how much I love you. Damn it. So he gets on his swim trunks and we start walking out the door and I'm already at the car ready to go. And he sits down on our front porch and I say, hey, Jackson, let's go. He doesn't even look up. And I notice I start getting impatient. And then luckily, I remembered my intention. What's the most important thing? I don't care if we go to the beach. I just want to spend time with my son. So I walk back over to where he's sitting and he was actually watching these ants. And I sit down next to him and we're kind of sitting there for a few moments. And then all of a sudden, I feel his little body begin to soften. And I feel his shoulder lean into my shoulder. I feel the sun on our backs. And that was it. That was the most important thing. But we forget. We forget so easily. So part of mindfulness is simply remembering what's most important. I want to invite you right now to take a moment, let your eyes close, and just connect with your intention. Why are you here? Why are you engaging on this journey of mindfulness? Perhaps it's to find greater ease, to reduce stress. Maybe it's to connect more with your children, your grandchildren. Maybe it's simply to improve your happiness. Whatever it is, just finding what your intention is. Feel it in your body. Good. You can let your eyes open. The second element of mindfulness is our attention, simply learning how to pay attention in the present moment. So I've been talking for about 6 or 7 minutes. I'm wondering if you've noticed that your mind has wandered. Don't worry, everyone's mind wanders. In fact, research from Harvard shows the mind wanders on average 47% of the time. 47%. So that's about half of our waking lives that we're missing, that we're not here. So part of mindfulness is simply training our attention, stabilizing our attention in the present moment so we can see clearly and respond effectively. The third element of mindfulness is our attitude. And this is the element that's most often overlooked. And I want to share with you why this is essential, why it's such an important part of mindfulness. When I was first learning about mindfulness, I went to Thailand and I did a meditation retreat at one of the monasteries there. I didn't know much about mindfulness, but I kind of understood it had to do with paying attention in the present moment. So when I got to the monastery, the monks didn't speak much English and I didn't speak any Thai. My only instruction was to feel my breath going in and out of my nose. So I began. One breath, two breaths, my mind wandered off. I'd bring it back. One breath, two, it wandered again. I'd get swept into the future and what I was scared about or what I hoped to do, or I'd get lost in the past. I wish I hadn't have done that, or if only I had done this. And no matter how hard I tried, I just couldn't stay in the present moment. Now, this was really frustrating because I had this romantic idea that I'd go to Thailand and I'd sit and meditate and all of a sudden I'd be at peace and enlightened. And instead, my mind was crazy. And so I started to try harder and I started to judge myself. What's wrong with you? You're terrible at this. Why are you even here? You're a fake. And then not only was I judging myself, I started judging all the monks around me. Why are they just sitting here? Shouldn't they be doing something? Luckily, a monk from London arrived who spoke English. And as I shared with him my struggles, he looked at me and he said, "Oh dear, you're not practicing mindfulness. You're practicing judgment, impatience, frustration." And then he said 5 words, which I've never forgotten. What you practice grows stronger. What you practice grows stronger. We know this now with neuroplasticity, and I'll be speaking about this later. But what he was teaching is that if I'm meditating with judgment, I'm just growing judgment. If I'm meditating with frustration, I'm growing frustration. He helped me understand that mindfulness isn't just about paying attention. It's about how we pay attention, our attitude, paying attention with an attitude of kindness and curiosity. He said, mindfulness is like these loving arms, and they welcome everything, even the messy, imperfect parts of ourselves. And yet this attitude of kindness is often so elusive for us. In my work with thousands of people, from stressed out college students to women with breast cancer to high-level CEOs, what I've been most struck by is the enormous sense of self-judgment, of shame, of self-doubt, of this, I'm not doing it right, I'm not good enough, I'm not okay. And my sense is, you know what they're talking about, just as I do, because all of us have experienced this shame, this self-doubt, this judgment. What I want to share with you is that shame doesn't work. Shame literally can't work. Physiologically, when we feel shame, the centers of the brain that have to do with learning shut down. What happens is the amygdala triggers a cascade of adrenaline and norepinephrine to flood our system. It shuts down the learning centers of the brain and shuttles our resources to survival pathways. Shame literally robs the brain of the energy it needs to do the work of changing. So what's the alternative? We've made a mistake. We've said something we shouldn't have. We don't want to do it again. I want to be clear that this isn't about letting ourselves off the hook. And yet, shame doesn't work. If it worked, maybe I'd say, go ahead, beat yourself up. But it doesn't work. So what's the alternative? An attitude of kindness. Kindness, unlike shame, turns on the learning centers of the brain. It bathes our system with dopamine and gives us the resources we need to change. True and lasting transformation requires kind attention. Mindfulness, then, is this synergistic co-arising of all three elements: intention, attention, and attitude. I want to share a story about mindfulness in action. So as many of you know, mindfulness has become quite popular in the United States, and it's even made its way into the military. And I want to share a story about a lieutenant who was referred to a mindfulness program for his severe anger management issues. At first, he was very resistant and didn't really want to engage, but eventually he started practicing. And about a month into the course, he shared this story. He's at the grocery store and he has a cart full of groceries. And in front of him is an elderly woman with a young baby girl. And she only has one single item. And he looks to the right and the express lane is completely empty. And he starts getting frustrated. Why isn't she in that lane? She's supposed to be in the correct lane. You know, he's in the military. He likes people to follow orders. But he remembers his mindfulness and he takes a breath. And then as he's standing there, he notices that the woman and the checkout clerk start cooing over the baby. And then all of a sudden, the woman hands the young cashier the baby girl for a hug. And he nearly explodes in anger. Are you kidding? Is this a nursery? What are they thinking? But again, he remembers his mindfulness and he brings his kind attitude to the situation and to his anger. And as his anger begins to subside, he looks up and he notices the baby girl is actually quite cute. A moment later, the little girl is back in the arms of the woman and they walk out the door. And as the young cashier is checking out his groceries, he says, "That little girl was quite cute." She looks up and she says, "Really? You think so? That's my daughter." And then she says, "My husband died in combat last year and I had to go back to work full time. So my mother brings her through my line every day so I can give her a hug." Can you feel in that moment how everything changes? Can you imagine how grateful he was that he was able to see clearly in that moment and respond wisely? That's really the heart of mindfulness, bringing us into the present moment, paying attention with this attitude of kindness and curiosity so we don't automatically react. So we can actually respond to each moment with wisdom and compassion. And yet everything I've shared with you about mindfulness doesn't matter unless we put it into practice. I want to share with you the science of the power of practice. As recently as the 1990s, we thought the brain was static and fixed, that it couldn't change. It's referred to as the doctrine of the unchanging brain. However, one of the most important discoveries in the past 400 years of brain science changed everything: neuroplasticity. We learned that the brain is malleable, that it can change. In fact, there's a very famous study of London taxi drivers that shows the visual spatial mapping part of their brain grew bigger and stronger after practicing navigating the 25,000 streets of London all day long. The same is true with meditation. When we practice meditation, what happens is the areas of the brain that have to do with creativity, attention, compassion, learning, memory grow bigger and stronger. It's called cortical thickening, the growth of new neurons in response to repeated practice. What you practice grows stronger. The monk shared this with me 20 years ago. He had probably never taken a course on neuroscience, but he understood this fundamental teaching. What we practice grows stronger. What this means is that all of us have the capacity to change. All of us can grow new neural pathways. We can even rewire our brain to be happier. This is very hopeful news, and I want to explain why. There's something in psychology called the happiness set point. And basically what decades of research has shown over and over again is that no matter what happens in our external life, we typically return to our baseline level of happiness. So they've done research on people who won the lottery and people who were in a terrible accident and became paralyzed. What happened is when you win the lottery, you have this blip of happiness. but then 1 year later, you go back to your baseline. Even more surprising, if you're in a terrible accident, your happiness decreases. 1 year later, you're back to your baseline. This is great news if you're born happy, right? No matter what happens in your life, it knocks you down, you pop back up. But this isn't such good news if you weren't born happy, because then no matter how great your wins, now no matter what successes you have, you always return to your baseline level of happiness. What is so hopeful about this new research is what it's showing is that even though external changes won't shift your happiness level, internal changes can. Happiness can be trained because the very structure of our brain can be modified, says neuroscientist Richie Davidson. What I like to say is anything can be trained because the very structure of our brain can be modified. Research by Dr. Sarah Lazar at Harvard shows that mindfulness practice can grow areas of the brain associated with happiness. It can grow areas of the brain associated with creativity, with memory, with emotional intelligence, with compassion. We can learn practices to rewire our brain and grow resources. If there's one thing that I want you to take with you, it's this. What you practice grows stronger. All of us have the capacity to change. So the question that really matters is, what do you want to grow? What do you want to grow in your life? So again, I want to invite you to take a moment and just listen. What do you want to grow? What's important in your life? See if you can soften your body 5% more and listen with your whole being, not with some mental idea of what you need to change in your life, but what do you want to grow? What will uplift you? It could be more peace in your life, more presence, more compassion, more joy. Just finding a word or phrase that feels true for you. Letting it seep into your body, into your cellular knowing. And then as you're ready, taking a deeper breath in and out. Good. So we've covered the research, we've covered the practice of mindfulness, and I want to invite us to just take a moment and let everything I've shared settle in. So let your eyes close and just let this information and these teachings really become part of your cellular memory. And perhaps focusing on one point that you want to remember. One, I call them gold nugget, one gold nugget that you really want to encode into your long-term memory. It could be what you practice grows stronger. It could be an attitude of kindness. It could be that all of us have the capacity to change. And as you're ready, taking a deeper breath in and out, letting your eyes open. Good. So next we'll be talking about essential themes of mindfulness and how to integrate them into your daily life.
Lecture 2. Essential themes of mindfulness.
Now that we know the power of practice, I want us to practice together. So take a moment and just settle into a comfortable position. Allow your eyes to close. And just focus on your intention. Why are you practicing? It could be to cultivate greater presence, greater attention, greater ease and relaxation, greater compassion. Whatever it is for you in this moment, just finding a word or phrase that reminds you of what's important. And then as you're ready, begin to gather your attention in the present moment, right here into the body. Go ahead and feel your feet on the floor, wiggle your toes, aware of both ankles and calves and shins. Feel your knees and thighs. Feel your seat, your hips, the whole pelvic floor. And then begin to draw your awareness up the spine. Feel your awareness move up the spine and spread out over the shoulder blades and shoulders. And just softening your shoulders. Let the awareness pour down both arms into the palms of the hands. And then just resting the awareness here in the palms of the hands. Maybe see if you can feel the pulse of your heart in the palms of the hands. This is your aliveness, this energy. Don't worry if you can't feel it, it's definitely happening. And then shifting your attention into your belly, just softening the belly. And notice that you're breathing, feeling the breath as it naturally flows into the body and out of the body. Feeling that natural rise of each inhale, a natural release of each exhale. Body knows exactly what to do, oxygenating with each inhale, releasing any stress and toxins with each exhale. And just allow this awareness of the breath to move up into the chest, feeling the chest expand with each inhale. Feel it fall with each exhale. And as you attend to your chest, see if you can feel your heartbeat. In fact, just put one hand on your heart and just see if you can sense or feel the beating of your own heart. Just like the breath, the heart knows exactly how to take care of you. The heart sending oxygen and nutrients to all the trillions of cells in your body right now. And you don't have to do anything. You don't have to remember or make it happen or control it. The heart knows exactly what to do. So see if you can just rest and let the heart take care of you. As you're ready, you can put your hand back in your lap and just continuing up into the throat. Up into the face, softening the jaw. Really unhinge the jaw, let it rest. Soften the eyes and the forehead, temples. Maybe just tilt your chin down a millimeter and let the back of the neck lengthen and open. Feel the back and sides and top of the head. And then just get a sense of the whole body resting here. Feel the front, right, left, back of the body. Maybe just leaning a little bit more of your attention into the back body and down. We tend to lean forward into the future. Resting back into the volume of the body. And then see if you can soften 5% more. And at the same time, heighten your attention. We can actually be physiologically at ease and yet laser-like in our attention. So softening, opening, And now, inviting in the attitude of kindness, of curiosity, really being interested in what your experience is like right now. Can you bring 5% more kindness to yourself? Whatever you're feeling is okay. It's just what you're feeling right now. Mindfulness isn't about changing our experience. It's about relating to it differently. Relating to whatever is here with kindness, with curiosity. And if at any point the mind wanders, which as we've learned it will, just bringing it back to this moment and to your breathing. The breath is a wonderful anchor to keep us in the present moment. So when the mind wanders off, we just gently bring it back. It's like a little puppy dog. It wanders off and you say, stay, stay. Wanders again, you say, come back. Right here, just this breath. See if you can stay with one breath at a time. Or maybe just half a breath, just this inhale, this exhale. What you're practicing is growing stronger. Practicing pathways of presence and kindness. Good. So as you're ready, taking a deeper breath in and out, letting some light come back in through the eyes and just moving the body in any way that feels comfortable. So often when we finish a meditation practice, many questions arise, and I want to see if I can answer some of the most common ones. One of the first things I hear from people is, I'm terrible at this. My mind wandered all the time. What can I do? So first, I want to reassure you, as we've learned, the mind wanders. It's what it means to be human. It wanders 47% of the time on average. So meditation is not about shutting down your thoughts or stopping your mind. It's about noticing the mind wander and bringing it back into the present moment without judgment, without condemning yourself, and without feeling like you're doing it wrong. What you're doing is you're learning how to focus and stabilize the attention in the present moment. And every time it wanders off, you bring it back. That's called shifting and switching attentional focus, and you're cultivating that pathway. The second common question I get a lot is people sit and meditate and they say, every time I meditate, I get so tired. Am I doing it wrong? So the reason you get so tired, and this is true pretty much across the board, it's because you're tired, right? Mindfulness is about seeing clearly what's true. And most of us are sleep deprived. And so when we actually sit to meditate, we start to notice how tired we are. So don't worry about doing anything wrong when you notice the tiredness. See if you can bring some kindness and compassion to it. And if it really gets difficult, I often invite people to just open their eyes. Just open their eyes and practice the mindfulness with eyes open. Because remember, meditation is just a way to practice mindfulness. Mindfulness we can practice in every moment. We're simply paying attention intentionally with an attitude of kindness and curiosity. The third question I often receive is, how do I handle physical or emotional pain? I'm sitting and I'm practicing my mindfulness, and either I'll have a pain in my back or some sadness or anger or confusion arise. So how do we bring our mindfulness to pain? The first thing to do is just simply acknowledge, I'm in pain right now, and to bring your kind, curious attitude to the pain. And then begin to really attend to it. For example, if I notice sadness arise in my meditation, to inquire, what does sadness feel like? Do I feel a tightness in my throat, or do I feel tingling or tears in my eyes? Can I bring this loving awareness to be with whatever's here? So you're almost like a parent who says to her child, "I'm here, I care, tell me what happened." In this way, meditation practice is learning to reparent ourselves, to welcome whatever is here. A final question I get is, how much do I need to practice? How much do I need to practice to get the benefits? What I'd say is this isn't an exact science, but we have done some research which shows that 12 minutes is the threshold where we start to see benefits, both physiologically and emotionally. Now, that doesn't mean 12 minutes is all you should meditate, but 12 minutes is kind of the minimum. And then after that, we see that the more you practice, the greater the benefit. Again, what you practice grows stronger. What I'd like to do now is talk a bit about how to begin a practice. And there are three key steps that I want to focus on. The first is having a clear intention for why you're practicing, really knowing why this is important. You want to use your intention to motivate you, to really inspire you to practice. You don't want meditation practice to be one more thing on your to-do list, one more thing you have to do. You want it to be something that really inspires you and connects you with what you truly value. So I want to invite you right now to take a moment and write down what your intention is for learning this practice. What is most important? Write down a simple word or a simple phrase. And then I'm going to encourage you to review this each day that you practice. And what's interesting is that our intentions shift. They evolve. They're dynamic. They're not static. So really listening each day, why am I practicing today? What's motivating me now? Good. The second step is to set ridiculously low goals. Don't start out with, I'm going to practice 1 hour every day for the next 10 years. Start small. Stay gentle. Baby steps. Choose a commitment that you can actually follow through on. You want to be able to trust yourself and trust your word and your commitments. I even recommend that people start with 1 minute a day, just 1 minute, to start to create the habit of practice. Now, I know I just told you that it takes 12 minutes to really see the benefits of mindfulness, but as you begin a practice, it's important to be consistent. So I remember my dentist once said to me, he said, start by flossing one tooth a day. And once you're already flossing one, you kind of get into the habit and you do a few more. So if you start with a commitment to 1 minute a day, you're certainly welcome to do more. But always know that at as a baseline, as a minimum, you're going to pause and meditate for 1 minute a day. The third step to beginning a practice is to make it a routine part of your daily life. Just like if you want to start exercising, you need to schedule it in. It's important with mindfulness practice to find a time to meditate that you put into your calendar and a place to meditate. I also find it very helpful to find a group to meditate with, or even just a friend, like a running buddy. You have a meditation buddy. And we have resources for you that we'll be sharing in this course. One final note is, be kind. This is not about doing it right. It's not about doing it perfectly. Maybe think practice, not perfect. This is about baby steps. It's about 5% more mindfulness. Even a few degrees changes everything. For example, think about the last time you had a fever. You have 102 fever, you're feeling chills, you're feeling terrible. And then you take a Tylenol, you bring it down to 99, 98. Just a few degrees, right? But it's a huge change. So little change has big impact. As you begin your mindfulness practice, really invite this kind, curious attitude, knowing that it's not about doing it right. It's not a self-improvement project. It's not about kind of beating yourself up so now there's one more thing to do. It's really about self-liberation. It's about greater degrees of freedom in your life. Greater degrees of joy, of ease, of compassion, of clarity. So now that we've learned about the research behind mindfulness and about how to practice it, I want to focus on some specific essential themes of mindfulness. The first theme of mindfulness is slowing down. So often in our life, we're rushing, we're hurrying, we're moving from one thing to another, and we get on this kind of automatic pilot mode of doing. What mindfulness invites us to do is to slow down so that we can stay connected to what we truly value. I want to share one of my favorite studies. This was done back in the 1970s at Princeton University. It's called the Good Samaritan Study. And what they did is they looked at seminary students who were becoming ministers. And one of their first assignments was to write a sermon about what it means to be a good person, a good Samaritan. So the students went home and they diligently prepared on their sermon and they came back to the university. And half the students, when they came back, their instructor said, "Oh dear, you're a little bit late and your lecture's all the way across campus and you better hurry because they're going to start without you." So those students started running across campus, really anxious that they were going to miss their first lecture. And as they're running across campus, they had a confederate, someone who was part of the study, fall down and say, "Oh, I'm hurt. Can you stop? Can you help me?" 100% of the students ran right by this person on their way to give a lecture about what it means to be a good person. Luckily, there's a second part to the study. So the second half of students, when they came in, their instructor said, "Oh dear, you're a little bit late, but don't worry. They're not going to start without you. Take your time." So they start walking across campus, still going at a good pace. The same confederate falls in front of them and says, "I'm hurt. Please help me." They stopped. They helped him. So part of mindfulness is about slowing down so we can stay connected to our true values, to our deepest compassion. A second theme of mindfulness is acceptance. I want to be really clear that acceptance is not about passive resignation. This is not about tolerating social injustice or wrongs that need to be righted. What acceptance means is that we acknowledge what's happening in the present moment, not because we like it, but because it's already happening. One of the most extraordinary mathematical equations I've learned is from one of my teachers, Shinzen Young. And what he says is that suffering equals pain times resistance. Suffering equals pain times resistance. So from the mindfulness perspective, pain is a part of life. Pain is constant. All of us are going to get sick. All of us are going to grow old. All of us are going to die. And so are the people that we love. Pain is a part of life. But suffering is optional. And suffering has to do with how much we resist and fight against the pain. For example, let's say that I have a little headache. Let's say I have 5 units of pain. If I start resisting the headache and I say, "Oh God, this is terrible. This is so painful. And I'm trying to do this course right now. And I really want to do a good job." And I'm resisting it, let's say by 100 units of resistance. I have 500 units of suffering. That's a lot of suffering over just a little headache. So now imagine I have the same 5 units of headache, but I don't resist it. I notice it with my mindful awareness, my kind attention, just a little bit of throbbing, tingling. It's more on the right side than the left side. I have 0 resistance, 5 units of pain. 5 times 0 is 0 suffering. Now, I remember when I was learning this, I was at a meditation retreat in Arizona, and it was a week-long silent meditation retreat. We were meditating every day, practicing. And when I heard this teaching, it felt a little too good to be true. Like, oh, if I just don't resist, I'm never going to suffer again. So I kind of tucked it away and went about my practice. And at the end of the retreat, I was heading home to California and I stopped by the grocery store just to get a quick snack for the airplane. And I was running a little bit late and I ran through the express lane. And right before I got there, a woman pulled in front of me with a cart full of groceries. 23 items, not that I counted. There was a clear sign that said 10 items or less. And so I noticed I started getting impatient and I started to judge her. Why is she in this lane? And then I noticed I was judging her and I started judging myself. Oh my God, what kind of meditator are you? You've just been like meditating for peace for all beings and now you're judging this poor woman who's just trying to get her groceries. And so I really started judging myself like, you're a fake, you're not real, you're pretending to be a good meditator. But then I realized I actually was sincerely practicing every day for a week. And all of a sudden I had this thought, oh my God, it's the meditation that doesn't work. and I've devoted my entire life to something that's a total farce. And then luckily this equation came into my mind, suffering equals pain times resistance. And I realized I had this little pain of waiting in line, maybe 2 units of pain, but I was resisting it by like a million. I was questioning my entire life, which was 2 million units of suffering. And so right in that moment, I dropped the resistance and just accepted. I'm going to be waiting in line for another minute, took a breath, practiced my mindfulness. And right in that moment, the woman looks back at me and smiles and says, oops, I'm so sorry. I said, no problem. And it wasn't. The third theme of mindfulness is response flexibility. The capacity to respond with agility and grace to what's happening instead of automatically reacting. What typically happens is when something stressful or unexpected occurs in our life, what's known as the amygdala hijack occurs, which is the amygdala gets completely triggered and releases all these stress hormones so that we can't think clearly and we automatically react. What mindfulness allows is a pause between the stimulus and response. And into that space, we can see clearly and then respond effectively. What mindfulness allows is for us to get out of that automatic pilot mode of doing and actually rest into a mode of being. In this space, there's infinite possibility. There's infinite potential. And so what mindfulness begins to offer us is more degrees of freedom in our life, where we don't have to automatically react, where we don't have to keep doing the same things over and over again, where we have choice and we can make change. A fourth theme of mindfulness is suspending judgment. As I mentioned before, mindfulness has this attitude of kindness and curiosity. And what it really invites is that we hold off on judgment. It doesn't mean that we don't see clearly or see with discernment, but judgment is different. For example, let's take poison. A judgmental view of poison is, this is bad, this is evil, it'll kill you. A discerning view of poison is, if you ingest it in this way, it will kill you. If you use it in this way, it could be a vaccination. So mindfulness is about suspending that judgment of right and wrong. And I want to share a story with you that I heard from Stephen Covey. He said he's in New York on a subway. And for those of you who have lived in New York, there's a certain protocol for being on a subway in New York. You mind your own business. You don't look up. You don't make conversation. So he's minding his own business and he's sitting there when a young father with 3 young children gets on the subway. And the young children start wreaking havoc. They're running around, they're yelling, being totally inappropriate. And Stephen Covey says, God, why isn't this father disciplining them? He starts really judging the situation. And after a couple more moments, the 8-year-old boy knocks over the cane of this elderly woman. And Stephen Covey says, that's it, I have to say something. And he leans over to the father and he says, excuse me, are these your children? And the father looks up a little bit dazed. He says, yes, can I help you? He says, well, why aren't you disciplining them? And the father says, I'm so sorry. We just left the hospital where my wife, their mother, died. And I don't know what to do. And you can feel how in that moment, everything changes. And Stephen Covey responds, can I help? How can I help? What mindfulness does is it allows us to see the situation more clearly, where we suspend the judgment to respond with all of our natural wisdom and compassion. The final theme I want to talk about is self-kindness. This seems to be one of the most elusive aspects of mindfulness and really deserves some focused attention. As I mentioned earlier, kindness is what allows us to transform. It's what allows us to change. Kindness turns on the learning centers of the brain. It gives us the resources we need to face difficulty in life and make change. So I want to share a story about how self-kindness has been so important in my own life. Some years ago, I was going through a very difficult divorce, and I'd wake up every morning with this pit of shame and fear in my stomach. My meditation teacher saw how much judgment, how much anxiety, how much fear I was practicing, and she invited me to begin a practice of self-kindness. She said, how about saying, I love you, Shauna, every day? And I looked at her and I said, no way. It felt so new agey or hippie. And so she said, how about just saying good morning, Shauna? And try putting your hand on your heart when you say it. It releases oxytocin. It's good for you, you know? She knew the science would win me over. So the next morning I woke up, put my hand on my heart. Good morning, Shauna. And it was kind of nice, right? Instead of the avalanche of self-judgment and shame, I woke up and just greeted myself with my own presence. After a few months, it became a really wonderful practice. And when I went back to see her, I said, thank you. That's been really helpful. Wonderful. You've graduated. Now the advanced practice. Good morning. I love you, Shauna. So the next morning, I went home, put my hand on my heart, took a breath. Good morning. I love you, Shauna. I felt nothing. Definitely not love. Maybe a little ridiculous, but definitely not love. But I kept practicing because, as we know, what you practice grows stronger. And then one day I woke up, put my hand on my heart, took a breath. Good morning. I love you, Shauna. And I felt it. I felt my grandmother's love. I felt my mother's love. I felt my own self-love. And I wish I could tell you that every day since then has been this bubble of self-love and I've never felt judgment or shame again. And that's not true. But what is true is this pathway of kindness has been established in me and it's growing stronger every day. So I want to invite you to take a moment, let your eyes close and just put your hand on your heart. And just take a moment to feel that kind touch. Where you're bringing your own kindness to yourself. And it's okay to feel whatever you're feeling right now. For some people, this feels really soothing and good. And for other people, it can be challenging to bring kindness to themselves. So using your mindful awareness to welcome whatever you're feeling. Feeling your breath. And maybe just inviting in 5% more kindness. 5% more compassion for yourself. Noticing how this feels. Softening the body 5% more. And just practicing this pathway of self-kindness. Notice if you have thoughts about doing it right and just let those go. You are doing it right. Simply practicing. Practicing your kind attention. So as you're ready, taking a deeper breath in and out. Letting your eyes open and just moving your body in any way that feels good. Good. So I offer you this practice. It's been so powerful in my life. And I want to invite you tomorrow morning when you wake up to put your hand on your heart, say good morning. And if you feel really brave, good morning. I love you. Thank you.
In the next two segments, Dr. Rick Hansen teaches you to use mindfulness to strengthen your inner resources while making the most of positive experiences.
So it's in this way that we cope, we adapt with changing conditions in life and find ways to maintain a lasting well-being in a changing world. The takeaway point here is that as challenges grow and as vulnerabilities grow, we need to increase resources as well.
Lecture 3, Using Mindfulness to Grow Inner Resources.
Dr. Rick Hansen is a psychologist and New York Times best-selling author. His work focuses on the need for mental resources such as mindfulness, self-compassion, and positive emotions, resources that we can acquire through learning. He explores how we can grow inner strengths. His breadth of knowledge is matched only by his dedicated and generous heart.
Hi, I'm Rick Hansen, and I'd like to talk with you about how to use mindfulness to grow inner resources of various kinds, like resilience, motivation, determination, confidence, self-worth, compassion, and happiness altogether, using the power of what's called positive neuroplasticity, the fundamental capacity of the nervous system to be changed, that's its plastic nature, and then positively changing it, helping it become better and better for your own sake from the inside out, and along the way, growing strengths and other resources inside that you can offer to other people. I'd like to begin by talking with you about the value of inner resources and framing it in terms of a model that's used routinely in healthcare and medicine and psychology. Its origin is in the term stress diathesis, the notion that stressors land on us and their impact is the result of the diathesis they make with other factors such as vulnerabilities and resources. So in this model, there's a notion that the course of a person's life over a day, a month, a year, or the lifespan altogether is really the result of just three factors, three kinds of causes. The challenges that wear upon a person, the vulnerabilities they penetrate through, and the resources that the person draws upon to deal with those challenges and to shore up vulnerabilities. A kind of silly but simple example of this is imagine that you're doing the dishes and you've got your hands deep into soapy water. It's full of germs and other crud. That's a challenge. And then let's also suppose that there's a little cut in your skin. That would be a vulnerability through which the germs could penetrate. But then to deal with it, you tap into the resource of nice big yellow rubber gloves, you put them on, and then you can keep on going. So it's in this way that we cope, we adapt with changing conditions in life and find ways to maintain a lasting well-being in a changing world. The takeaway point here is that as challenges grow and as vulnerabilities grow, we need to increase resources as well. And as a clinician, a parent, an educator, a coach, a business consultant, and a mindfulness teacher, I've seen many situations in which the challenges and the vulnerabilities were high and the person was under-resourced. So that's what I want to focus with you on here, how to grow resources. Now, to grow resources from a practical standpoint, like challenges and vulnerabilities, we might find resources out in the world, in the body, and in the mind. All are important places to intervene, but if you think about it, the mind has a special advantage in that we're able to influence it routinely and we take the benefits with us wherever we go. So I'm going to focus here on the fundamental process of growing resources, inner strengths, capabilities, know-how, positive mood, and the healing of earlier life experiences. I'm going to talk with you about how to do that, how to grow those resources hardwired into your own nervous system. Before I dive into the details, though, I'd just like to mention some well-known fundamental resources. Mindfulness, which is foundational for growing the rest of them, because if we're not mindful of our situations, we won't know which resources to develop. And as you'll see, we need to sustain mindfulness to the experiences that we're having to help them leave lasting traces behind as a durable change in neural structure or function. So additionally, we have classic character virtues. I was a Boy Scout and I learned to be thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent, and I think eight other virtues. Knowing how to lean into an interaction and knowing when to lean back. Knowing how to get something done, to manage a meeting, to work with a team of other people. Knowing how to deal with your own thoughts and feelings. Skills of various kinds. Those are inner resources. Certain motivations, positive intentions, values, aims, dreams that are wholesome and useful, those also are inner resource. And then certainly positive mood happiness is itself a fundamental psychological resource. There's a lot of research that shows that happiness is very helpful for dealing with really hard conditions in life, an authentic happiness, not a fake it till you make it happiness. And so we're going to explore how to grow positive mood and positive emotions in general. And certainly key resources include things like compassion and caring and love for other people.